bases loaded and one out.
Oh, my God.
Deep to right field. Way up there and way out of here. Second deck walk-off home run. Grand slam.
What is going on, everybody? Mike here from This Loaded Fantasy Baseball Podcast and joined, not as always, but as often as possible, by George. You can follow on Twitter at @Roto_Nino. George and I are obviously, for those who might be new to the podcast side of things on YouTube, George is my co-host. We usually do a lot more in the offseason, but in season things get crazy. He's getting married in a few days. So congratulations to that, buddy. I know you have a lot going on there, but glad we can join together. It's episode 200. It's supposed to be a milestone, yet here we are, just the two of us, as if I thought we were supposed to be more like of a grand gesture. Like we're supposed to go out and get these special guests or go. No, it's just us again.
Yeah. Hey, man, that's the totally cool with me. When I saw 200 was coming up, I'm like, yeah, we got to make sure we're both on there for 200. Yeah. Like you said, it's just been crazy, crazy busy. Been keeping up with our content over at GTE. And then, yeah, getting married next weekend. So still have a lot going on there. The anxiety is like through the roof right now. So as soon as that's over, it's going to be a relief, but it's definitely something I'm looking forward to. It's crazy, man. 200 episodes. And like, just thinking back today, like when it started, like we went through the whole pandemic and like we started before, you know, those, what was like 2019 we started.
Yeah, it was 2019. My first ever sleeper was Josh Bell. My first ever bust was Alberto Mondesi. I think I might have had Vlad on my bus list that year, which I was right about that year. Then I was wrong about every year since, basically. But it was one of those things I remember because I actually did the first ever episode by myself, and it was Sleepers Breakouts and Busts. And then I was like, I randomly tweeted out to the Twitterverse, "Hey, I just want a co-host." We never knew each other. We weren't friends before this. We met because we're both like, "Why not? Let's do this podcast." I set these weird expectations up. I actually texted, for those who don't know the backstory, I texted the wrong George Montanez once upon a time.
Because I gave you the wrong number.
You gave me the wrong number, but I think it was like one digit off. And yep. When you gave me that number, this person was playing along super into it. And then it was amazing. They sent us a picture of this dog. What was his name? Dinger? We named him?
Dinger, yeah.
Oh, right. My goodness. We had it. I wish, you know what? I wish we had the picture so I could show Dinger off to the YouTube people. But one thing I do have I want to show is the original one of the original podcast pictures. It's super cheesy. This is what it was back in the day. I mean, it was red lettering, I think, is what we ended up going with. This is the only one I could find of like the original first. This was our logo for the podcast, and it has since turned into other stuff. Hey, Twitter, you weren't supposed to be there yet. We will remove you because I was sending you stuff on Twitter. But anyway, and we're gonna talk some players tonight. We're gonna talk some early takeaways, how we're adapting. Is it too early to attack needs in fantasy, so to speak? And I should have probably mentioned this at the beginning, so those watching who already clicked off, they won't even care. But for those listening, you knew we were gonna talk a little bit about the past, but also gonna talk about analysis and small samples. Like, what are we taking away from it? Is there much that we can get out of this early analysis? Is it just, are we overthinking it? And of course, we're going to talk closers, because if there's ever a day and age to cover closers, or at least be on top of them, it's now. They treat closers like they treat platoons. You know, it's just like who's in, who's out, who's up, who's down, who's trending which way. And guess what? That is what George covers best. And we're going to talk about a few players that are underperforming, overperforming, concern levels, and more. I hate to cut off the nostalgia, but I think it's time we get into the content a little bit. George. Yeah. Early takeaways in terms of like the potential for new ball, the pitch clock, you're seeing obviously pitchers, the ERA, the ratios are getting absolutely decimated, destroyed, pick a word. It's like a nuke went off in fantasy baseball or in baseball general, and ratios are exploding in the process. What are you doing? Like, how have you, like, is this something we should be expecting as the weather gets warmer to keep going, getting worse? Do we expect pitchers to adapt a little bit in the middle? Where are you at with this?
Yeah, man, just like everyone else, I'm, you know, over here tilting just about every night from a different pitcher getting hit. So it's been rough. It's been rough for sure. There's just been so many factors, right? Just this whole adjustment period has been crazy. We've had different injuries. I mean, outside of like a handful of pitchers, right? It's like you're struggling somewhere. I don't know. I think it is early. You know, we're only, you know, 3 weeks into the season. I'm not necessarily like chasing categories, but I am aware of like, you know, where I'm falling behind in. You know, there are some leagues where it's like, yeah, everyone's getting blown up. So it's like, at this point, do I just go chasing the wins and strikeouts and let the ratios just kind of fall where they go? I mean, yeah, hopefully, you know, as the more experience that these guys have with the pitch clock and then the warmer weather, we start seeing things kind of normalize a little bit. But yeah, it's been rough in the early going, even just like covering the relievers on a day-to-day basis. I mean, even they've been, you know, pretty volatile. So yeah, it's been rough.
Not to mention you have obviously the early season weather issues. So you're having velocity changes. It's hard. And that's when you have to start looking like you're really microanalyzing, because you get velocity up, velocity down. All right. Well, oh, they were in a dome today. Oh, they were outside. So the velocity being down, the weather being bad, that makes sense. But when a player loses some velocity and they're in a dome, you're like, wait, what? That takes note. That's, you know, something worth noting. And it's like, so we're kind of playing this daily game of seeing what's going on, especially because of how volatile it's been as a position. We're trying to figure out what edge we can gain. And honestly, like, there's guys like Justin Steele and Sonny Gray just crushing it right now. And so the regression monster hasn't come for them yet, but it's coming. But then you have guys like Gossman, who had the get wrong game, so to speak, because he's been getting it right all season. Lizardo kind of had a get wrong game, you know, with the Giants. So no one is safe, although I've been fortunate to start off better than most in some of my leagues, some of my later drafted leagues. But I lost Woodruff, you know, people. Scherzer's up for 10 days now on a suspension after some BS. You also have Verlander out. So even guys that, even when you drafted heavy pitching, there's a lot of injury to pitchers already, which again happens every year. There's also the fact that, like, the good pitcher, not all the good pitchers are pitching good. There's some, it's hard to determine which bad pitchers you should be streaming. I streamed Gibson a couple times and got a couple wins out of it. He has more wins than some of the starters I actually drafted from day one. So it's just like, there's a lot ups and downs. You kind of have to just ride it out and trust your preseason projections. Still, for the most part, there are tangible things to take away from it. But in terms of, okay, I guess we'll skip to this one and go back to the other question I have on our outline here. But in terms of analysis, what I mentioned, obviously, you know, weather, velocity and stuff, but what other stuff are you looking into this early that you can kind of take away from these small samples, if anything?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, you still got to kind of trust your preseason analysis and stuff. Like, you know, we're still just 3 weeks in. Just a couple days ago, I had like Spencer Strider and Christian Javier, and I still rolled out Hayden Wisniewski, and they all had good outings this week, and I jumped like 11 standings points. Like, we're still in that point of the season. So I'm kind of taking a look, like, when it comes to, at least with like the pitchers, like, yeah, you're monitoring velocity. You want to see guys have better control. Like, the one guy was like Luis Garcia of the Astros. He was, you know, it was him and Javier over the first few starts. Like, we're showing, like, you know, a little bit diminished velocity. Garcia in particular was kind of all over the place with his control. He was using his fastball, and like, you, when he's walking guys and getting, and that fastball gets crushed, and he's, you know, it just exacerbates the problem. On my bench, he goes like 7 innings and 9 strikeouts. I had him on my bench everywhere. So yeah, he wasn't someone I was dropping, but it's just one of those examples where, like, oh, he made an adjustment, velocity was up a little bit, and there you go, 7 innings, 9 strikeouts, and he's probably going to be just fine too. So yeah, I'm not being too reactionary. The guys that have come up, like, that have kind of come onto the scene, like Taj Bradley and stuff, I picked up a lot of Taj Bradley. Like, those are the kind of moves I'm making, where I'm trying to get in on some guys early. But yeah, I'm trying not to be too reactionary. I know, like, in this day and age, like, you know, as much as like betting is exploding and stuff, we all want that instant gratification. We want to see our teams and our players doing well, like, right off the bat. We want to see the outcomes. But no, you just, I think it's just important to just kind of stay patient and disciplined.
Yeah, and you mentioned Garcia's difficulty in terms of locating, and so I pull up his Savant page, and you'll see that his four-seamer Look at that hot zone. Just look at it, George.
Yeah.
That's not what you want.
Forcing was already bad. And so much in the zone right there if you're looking at the screen.
If you're watching on YouTube. That's why
it's hard. Middle of the zone.
It is as hot as it gets right down the middle. Yeah. He's not hitting up. He's not hitting down. He's pretty much living right down the middle, like middle of the zone with his forcing, where that's Luis Garcia of the Astros we're talking about. And if for those listening, again, youtube.com/IGTFantasy to see the visuals behind it. But yeah, that's why I was like, I brought him up because I'm like, you mentioned him. And I was like, let's talk about him. I just wanted to pull that up. Like, hey, let's show them. Oh, it's bad. But yeah, like you mentioned, these players, these pitchers, they are adapting. They are adapting to the pitch clock. They're adapting to timing. They, you know, early season struggles, whether we talked about that too. It's just, it's normal. So being patient with these guys you draft in the early rounds make a lot of sense. But then there's guys like, I don't know, for instance, we're looking early on. I like to look at pitch mix changes. I like to see if a player is having some early success with a pitch mix, or a guy like a Justin Steele who's having success coming off of a pitch mix change in the second half where it started leading to more success. And you're seeing that carry over. So now it makes it easier to believe in Justin Steele a little bit. He's not as good as he's been, but you get the point there. And then you have obviously – I'm trying to think of another. I can't really think of another name right now, but you get my point. It's kind of pitch mix changes followed by change in production. And then you have guys like Edward Cabrera, which I talked about on the episode that dropped today. So this is dropping the next days. So I'm not going to get too much into it, but he's another guy in two starts. You know, he looked terrible, was walking the yard. Next two starts, he adapted. And what mattered in those adaptations he made was Cabrera, you know, changed up his pitch mix and started getting better results in terms of overall just – not walking as much, strikeouts were there, and just looked better. So players are also making changes start to start. So if you're really trying to get granular and truly trying to catch on to trends as they happen, you monitor these players start to start and you realize, okay, good, bad, good, good, bad, good, good, bad. What happened? Okay, then you take away those four good ones and look at what happened to those four games and maybe realize, okay, so 4 out of 5, you figured it out, and maybe he'll start and he's starting to change his ways. You know what I mean? So you have, that's where the analysis is kind of progressing to, because as you mentioned, we have more information than ever before. So we're always going to try to, we always have to try to keep up with the ever changing, you know, thing, the world that is fantasy or that is baseball in general. And in order to stay a step ahead of everyone is to be that granular with as many players as possible, which is impossible. You know, I'm keeping an unsustainable pace right now with how much I'm covering, but it is what it is. And a guy, for instance, a guy like Jose Berrios, here's a quick look into some of my notes that I had planned for another episode. The last two starts, Berrios has been quote unquote back. I wouldn't say he's quite back yet, but if you look at Berrios, he made two solid outings in a row, right? Well, pitch mix has fluctuated, so it wasn't a pitch mix thing. It was like rather inconsistent. Like one start, he leaned heavier on the fastball. The other one, he leaned heavier on the slurve. The strand rate, but if you look at the last two starts in particular compared to the first for Berrios, the last two starts, you saw the strand rate improve, but I would call it more of a correction because it was so underwhelming and so below average that it kind of got closer to average. Actually, still below average, but still close enough. But the big thing I noticed was that Berrios attacked the zone more. And with Berrios, that was what I noticed. The big thing was when he attacked the zone more, it was a 10% difference. We're talking a zone rate of 37.5% for Berrios in the first two starts compared to 46.8%. So he's not getting the strikeouts. The strikeouts took a bit of a hit. We saw the O swing, which is a chase rate. We saw that dip, and we saw the swinging strikes dip. But he gave up the chases. He gave up the swinging strikes to induce more contact, and it's been weaker contact, whereas by trying to play too much of like location games, I think he was missing his spots too often. And when he missed his spots, he was getting crushed in those first two starts. Whereas Berrios attacking the zone a lot more these last two starts, not trying to be too picky of where he's trying to locate. And it's worked out for him in terms of inducing weaker contact and overall better numbers minus the strikeout stuff. So I think Berrios is figuring it out. I don't think the ceiling is what it was or what it once was, but I think there is a path to a good floor if he can continue these changes and continue to find success with the changes we've seen these last two starts. And this is where that granular look comes in, because now early in the season, like it's going to take how bad he was the first two starts. Those last two starts still haven't really truly shown that the production, how much has changed in the last two starts, because he inflated his ratio so much. It's going to take more than two good starts to get him to where they need to be. And that's why paying attention to these little intricate parts of a player's game and changes throughout start to start early on can make a difference and make something like a Berrios like more palatable. And not to mention those two starts that he's had success in, what they came against the Astros, and it was another, I thought it was like another good offense. No, he plays for the Blue Jays. Who did they play that night though? I can't remember the other start. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, honestly. I'm not sure. But yeah, I don't have any Berrios myself, so I haven't really been following too much.
I just follow him because when I do my daily recaps, I notice, you know, I just notice like things are changing. And it was the Rays. That's right. He was the first Rays loss. That was the big thing. The Rays have been running hot.
That's right.
He shut them down. He followed up that Rays outing with a Houston Astros outing. So are the strikeouts down because of the two really strong offenses he faced? That's also a possibility. So either way, though, we saw a change in attack, a change in game plan at least. And the fallout being so positive for Berrios and against the teams that they faced, both teams. I mean, I know the Astros aren't full strength, but they're still top tier offense. And then you have the Rays who have beat everybody. So yeah, that's why it's like there's a little bit. I'm cautiously optimistic for Berrios. All that was my long winded way of saying I'm cautiously optimistic for Berrios. But I'm with you. He was actually available in my main. I bid on him, but not nearly enough. He went way more than I expected coming off one good start against the Rays. And I mean, maybe I'll regret that because I also didn't bid heavy enough on Taj. And looking at Taj early on, you mentioned Taj looks fantastic. And I might have underestimated how much he will pitch this year. And that's my bad. I was never doubting the skills, but it's a big L if I just not going hard enough. Now, I don't even know if I would have bid enough on him. So it doesn't matter if I take a win or a loss technically because I was never out on the skills. But man, I'm bummed because everyone, like, my team's okay with pitching, but I lost Woodruff. And I'm going to go through other losses at pitching, and I have my eyes on other guys. And one of them is Mason Miller we'll talk about. But before we get into that, I want to know in terms of in general overall strategy talk here, how is it too early? Is there such thing as having needs this early? And if so, do you attack them? Or besides obviously the ones that come from injury, you know, obviously Woodruff goes down, Verlander went down at the beginning of the year, you know, stuff like that. Besides the obvious injury stuff, do you look at the standings right now and kind of try to stream some players to try to hit certain stats? Do you try to attack waiver wire for certain streamers, certain stats as well? Or is it too early to really worry about that? Cause you have guys like, for instance, Tovar not stealing bases, even though he was projected to and stuff like that. You know what I mean? Like, are you making these apps? Are you trying to adapt early, or are you kind of just, again, giving a little more time before you truly attack needs off the waiver wire or trade or whatever you do?
Yeah, I think I might be waiting a little bit before like aggressively attacking any needs. I mentioned earlier, like the whole ratios thing, like maybe I'm being a little bit more careful now, or it's tough. It's a tough balancing act because it's like, do you just go chasing the wins and strikeouts? I don't really know. It's that one's, you know, it, I think it's still a little bit too early.
I think when it comes to chasing those wins and strikeouts, the issue is you have a real good chance of inflating your ratios even beyond what they are. You don't
want to do that too early. Yeah. Cause it is hard to come back from.
I think it's better to stabilize those ratios as early as possible before chasing that stuff. Whereas, you know, I got a little cute with Gibson, but I got two of three wins by streaming. I got lucky, I think, more so than anything, but I also attacked this matchups. However, in 15 teamers, when I'm doing this stuff, it's usually almost out of necessity because it's either him with a really good matchup or somebody else with like a terrible matchup or a terrible two start or a guy that's like coming off injury, like Brian Bayo, who I shouldn't have started, but I couldn't help it. I was so excited for Bayo's return. But like, for instance, I did attack what I felt were perceived needs. My team has been lacking in power, so to speak, like just slow starts. Other than Matt Chapman and Acuna, my team's been, you know, Josh Naylor's on a cold streak, and we can actually add him to the outline because I've had some questions about him, actually quite a few. But Josh Naylor's on a cold streak, among other names like that. But that was one that stuck out to me. I have guys like Oswaldo Cabrera, who's just a good, solid all-around guy, but not really a power guy. I have who else do I have? That's Lourdes Gurriel Jr., another just solid all-around guy, but not a power guy. So I'm like, I have these high-floor guys. My batting average is decent. So I went out and made a point to get Carpenter and Berger. And of course, this is where that instant gratification kicked in. Cause you saw, you know, I was texting us. I was so that day because I got a Berger home run and a Carpenter home run. And Carpenter's actually been good this whole first half of the week. I knew Berger was probably a 1 week starter type of thing. Cause I know Moncada's working his way back, but Carpenter, as long as there's righties on the agenda or on the schedule, Carpenter's going to play. And Carpenter is a power first guy. And of course, they both had a home run the Monday, which was like that instant gratification. But then I accidentally set Kepler over the wrong. I made a rookie mistake here. Read the lineups properly. I saw Oswald Peraza, and I instantly thought of Oswaldo Cabrera for the Yankees. So I flipped in Cabrera over Kepler because I'm like, Kepler gets a lefty. He's batting eighth against Sale. And Kepler ends up going yard that game. And meanwhile, I had no, and Oswaldo Cabrera actually didn't start because I did the whole classic Oswald versus Oswaldo mix up. So I lost a home run on my bench, which sucked. But again, early, I'll make it up, I'm sure. However, if I miss the overall by a home run, I will look back and think about how much I hate that mix-up, right? Could you imagine? But yeah, so that's the type of thing. It's where I looked at it like I kind of saw a need just because I saw how my team was performing. And I have no – in a deeper format – and again, I'm emphasizing deeper formats. I have no problem riding hot hands off the bench, especially for cheap or off the waiver wire for cheap, seeing where it goes, because we've seen guys like – Patrick Wisdom's on like, what, 5 or 6-game home run streak right now? It's ridiculous. But guys like him do this.
I think that's a good point, like as especially in deeper leagues. Like I have teams with like Anthony Santander, Christian Walker, guys that like I drafted for power that I'm not – you know, you're not getting that power quite yet. And so like I'll stream in my utility spot. Like 2 weeks ago, I was looking at Franchy Cordero. This last week, I was looking at Jack Suwinski, looking at the Coors series, the good matchups for the Pirates. And that those are streams that like have worked out where like I'm getting that power that I haven't been getting. Like I'm not benching Anthony Santander and Christian Walker, but like am I going to stream some guys that are interesting, you know, off the wire for, you know, those categories that I'm not getting quite yet? Like, yeah, sure.
And that's going to bring us to our next thing. Now we talked about some strategy talk. We're talking, and now it's time to get into what you are known for. This is your thing, George. This is what you do for GTE. You do a reliever recap almost daily, if not daily, I believe. Lately it's been daily. You've been doing a lot of them, but you go through all the savant stuff. You go through the recent usage. You discuss relief pitchers, who's up next and who you have your eye on. And you've always been my guy for this. So let's talk about something. I have nothing written down here, so I'm going to let you lead the way here with what you want to talk about, who has your attention, what situations to monitor. It's all yours, buddy. Yeah.
So it's been the first thing I do every morning. I'll get up and I'll recap basically all the relevant like bullpen information from the day before, and that'll go up on the GTE website, and I'll you know record who's gotten saves, who got holds that day, and I'll do like a little write up on each situation every day where it's like, you know, that someone's, you know, I'll also include like all the swing and strike percentages and all that. So yeah, I've been trying to stay on top of all that, like as good as possible so far. And I should be able to do that, you know, throughout the season. Probably will be off next week for the wedding. But
I was gonna say you're getting married. I expect one in the morning of your actual of your whole thing. You know, I want it done before you walk the aisle, you know?
Yeah. But you know, this draft season, I wasn't comfortable with a lot of the prices, a lot of the situations. I thought maybe this year, you know, you could kind of get by going late closer. I didn't think, you know, maybe it won't take as many saves to be a competitive, or at least like finish middle of the pack where you can, you know, really solidify other positions early on. And, you know, it's kind of looking that way. You're seeing, you know, maybe a half dozen situations where like you feel really good about it. You know, Felix Bautista in Baltimore has been awesome. Emmanuel Clase is, you know, he struggled the first few times out, but he's looks like he's back. He's stringed together some good outings now. So you got Clase, Bautista, one of your guys, Clay Holmes.
Although he's, you know, had his couple rough outings too. So
he's had a couple rough outings. Kenley Jansen, he's been great to start off. Devin
Bossy's been up there too for him. It was weird. Kenley just randomly wasn't everybody concerned about Kenley and his like lack of the whole being slow worker in between pitches and stuff? That was like a whole thing. I remember a whole narrative of him, and he's coming out throwing gas harder than ever while he's adapting.
The velocity, it's been up. The same with Aroldis Chapman.
He's been juicing.
Incredible too.
He's juicing. I don't believe he's not juicing. Suddenly, all of a sudden, got all that velo back. No, screw you, man. You're lying. You're a cheater. I don't believe. There's no testing right now.
You've got Jordan Romano, David Bednar that you feel good about, but outside of that, I mean,
you need like five closers.
exactly. You know, maybe, you know, AJ Minter has been really useful. I mean, but the Rays are just blowing everybody out. So he's barely gotten any save chances. But, you know, Minter has been the closer with Atlanta. He's been fine. Even like Ryan Helsley. I don't know, you know, how often the Cardinals are going to let him do like back to backs. You've seen like Gallego step in. For a save. So you're just seeing a lot of these situations all around the league where it's just like pretty matchup dependent. Josh Hader is another one that, you know, you feel fine and good about. But a lot of those guys, Camilo Duvall, Scott Barlow, You know, Daniel Bard, he just came back, but unfortunately, you know, he had to miss the start of the season with anxiety. Who knows how that situation is going to go? The Dodgers too, they haven't really had many save chances. I think, yeah, Evan Phillips is kind of taking the first couple of saves there. But there's just so many situations where you're looking at a timeshare. Like, you know, Michael Fulmer, Brad Boxberger splitting saves there in Chicago. I would still think that Fulmer is the guy to roster there, but they're gonna give some save chances to Brad Boxberger if the situation calls for Fulmer to pitch the eighth. Same with David Robertson. We've seen him used in non-save situations, you know, eighth inning, top of the order's coming up, and Adam Ottavino has the last two saves for the Mets. You know, so there have been some that emerged. Unfortunately, with Andrés Muñoz's injury, Paul Sewald's just kind of taking control there. So he's been coming through, but who knows what happens, you know, when Muñoz does come back. The Angels, Carlos Estevez was one of my late targets. It's funny because we text back and forth, and I remember you saying, like, Estevez is never available.
And when he goes out and throws 30 pitches a night. And
right, then he goes.
It's frustrating because the stuff looks good, but he's having issues locating, it looks like. So he's giving up hard hits, he's giving up home runs, and then Quijada looks great, but Quijada's a lefty. I don't know. And it's like they're both factoring, though. And then the other night, I think I saw Estevez get brought in for a non-safe situation, but it was against the top of the order, or the middle of the lineup. So it was a high leverage situation. So he's still getting, it looks like Estevez is still getting the most high leverage of situations. However, I want the guy getting the saves. And the issue is Quijada is always more available and he seems to be more efficient there. That's all I was going to bring up, that situation. Cause obviously that's one I am very invested in because I need freaking saves, man. But at the same time, I can't trust Quijada as much as I can trust Estevez. Honestly, any given week, either one of them get two or three saves. It wouldn't surprise me if it was Quijada one week, Estevez the next, depending on how that team, you know, wins. And then yesterday it was a 3-2 game. I'm like, so, and it's the Yankees and the Angels. So I'm like, sweet, I got a save from somebody. No, neither one of my freaking guys got saves. Neither one of Holmes or Estevez got saves in that game. But it was a 3-2 game. The Yankees won, and neither one of my guys got saves. I was really frustrated. I was like, how does that happen? Why? I just need saves. I give up.
Yeah.
Anyway,
this is the world that we live in now, man. This is just the world that we live in now.
I don't like it.
If you don't have, or even if you do have one, like I mentioned, like there's less than 10 guys you feel really great about. So like, even if you have one of those guys, no matter what, like you're constantly looking at the waiver wire, looking at, you know, stream a reliever, pick up the next guy. I have some teams where I picked up my closers. I picked up like AJ Puck and Jose Alvarado, and I drafted Evan Phillips, and I'm rolling with those three, and I'm top half of the league in saves, rolling with Alvarado, Puck, and Phillips. So I just, yeah, at this point, I'm just like, okay, who's got the skills? Who's in the mix for some saves? And I'm just going to roll with those guys.
Now, a team I wanted to ask about, the team that everybody wants saves from, the Tigers, you know, naturally. Only because I saw Jason Foley get a save. I think it was the second save of the season. And in terms of ratios, he's been the best. Obviously, not the biggest strikeout guy. But it was his first save. I thought it was the second for some reason. It was the first save of the season. But, you know, nine strikeouts per K per nine of nine. But 26.7% strikeout rate's good. But the 10% walk rate, not good as a closer. I don't know, I was just looking at him a little bit just because, again, that seems like such an unsettled situation. We've seen Alex Lang pitch as early as the seventh, as late as, like, obviously save situations. Is it just one of those where it's either Alex Lang or bust, especially after we saw Windhunter blow the save too and kind of just avoiding it?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I would say like Lang is still the only reliever there that's kind of worth rostering. Foley did get the save, but it was the second game of a doubleheader. I think Lang had actually gotten the save in game one, and Foley got the save in game two. Foley, I think, would be the next guy. We did see Wingenter get the save chance that he just completely blew. I don't even think he recorded an out in that outing. So, I would think Foley is now like the next guy. But just given like just the team context and the whole situation, I mean, Lang would still be the guy that I'm rostering there. Probably the only one worth rostering.
You killed my hopes. I had hopes that maybe I'm like, maybe he's worth a couple bucks. I'm not gonna bother.
Foley's probably one of those guys too that like you throw, you know, just a buck or two on every week. You churn, you know, you have a roster spot to just churn. You throw, you know, you roster Jason Foley for a week, and who knows, you know, who knows what happens, what can happen there. So
Woodruff took that roster spot away from me. That jerk. So I just want to bring it up real quick. Everyone's talking about it. We don't have to waste a lot of time, but Mason Miller obviously came out, looked electric. But other than that, I mean, obviously lived in the zone a little bit with the fastball. The cutter was living around the edges where you like it. The slider was apparently in the dirt. I'm just looking. But obviously very small sample. Mason Miller, we know, has the upside, but we also know the narrative here. What, 30-something innings, crosses pro history, whatever, came in, threw 80-something pitches in four and a third. So obviously his pitch counts around the 80 to 85 range. It'll push up, but we can't trust the innings. Teams will adapt, play pitches for the A's. So if he's already limited in terms of the likelihood of going five innings, on top of that, it's a team in the A's that won't win many games. So how many wins are we expecting? As you can tell from my tone, I'm rather down on him. Are you optimistic in terms of like this year at all? Or are you kind of feeling the same way?
No, I'm kind of feeling the same way. I feel like after his first outing, I mean, and he was getting strikeouts on 102-mile-per-hour fastballs.
Yeah.
He's probably going to go for more than I'm willing to put down on him this weekend to pick him up. Just for the concerns that you mentioned there, he barely has any professional innings under his belt. That, you know, you're not sure how many you're going to get there, if he's going to hold up, and how many wins he's going to get. So, you know, maybe you're getting some solid ratios and strikeouts, which is worth something, you know, for as long as he is pitching. But I think there are going to be other opportunities that are worth paying up for that may come up like in the next month. So that's kind of where my like hesitation is. Like, We saw like Taj Bradley go for a bunch. We saw like Chris Bubich go for a bunch.
Yeah, don't mind me.
Yeah.
Did I show you the picture? Well, I don't know if I sent the picture of that for our group chat where I had Chris Bubich where I won him in that same line of bids. I had Oviedo for like $3 or $4 on there, and he went unclaimed. It was like $7, went unclaimed, and then the next week he went for 125. Whereas if I didn't win Bubich, I think I would have ended up with either Keller or Oviedo, both of which were lower on that bid string, and both of which would have been way worth, obviously worth the money. Even if I missed on Oviedo, I would have at least got Keller, who has his own little interesting stuff going on, not as much as Oviedo right now, but still something. It was one of the things where I was like, I really had to win this guy, and I got what was considered a good price compared to the market. And still, obviously, it cost me more because now not only did it cost me the fab that I had to burn the next day, basically, but then it also cost me missing out on one of those other guys lower on the bid list. And who else did I have ahead of him? Braxton Garrett, who I actually am really happy with right now, especially now with the Rogers injury, Trevor Rogers injury with the forearm. Good chance that we see Garrett get a good amount of run in that line of spot. We saw how good he could be over a long term. So I think either way, even though I'm just a little humble brag, I guess. I got lucky that it lasted longer than I expected, and I got ahead of the market there without really meaning to. So sometimes you need some luck to go your way. But
yeah, look, yeah, I got
lucky and unlucky in the same freaking situation. So you take your lumps, but when I do the math, it makes you feel worse because I spent 10% of my fab, over 10% of my $1,000 fab on just Chris Bubich and Braxton Garrett. And when you think about it like that, it's like I just spent a little over $100 on a Marlins pitcher and a Royals pitcher, because but when you look at the waiver wire, that's kind of all that's there, other than call-ups. Obviously the guys on the wire are on the wire for a reason. They're usually on bad teams, and Garrett Cooper was another guy I got early, and he's another guy I'm actually happy to have, but another Marlins player. So it's like there's a reason why the good players that are available are usually on the bad teams, because they always lack somewhere in terms of a counting stats. Like with Oviedo, in his case, it's going to be wins, and Garrett Cooper's case, it's probably going to be runs or RBI, whichever one depends on where he hits in the lineup. But you get my point. There's always a quality in a player off the waiver wire that you're like, unless it's a call up on a big team and he starts smashing right away, there's always a reason why there's a guy on the waiver wire is how I look at it. There's always a reason why he was there. And although like Oviedo, for instance, making all these changes looks really good, he's just, it's still like, he doesn't, like, how many wins are we getting there? That's still a stat you need. But like you mentioned with Miller, getting back on topic here, you're going to get the ratios, you'll get the strikeouts, but the ratios are assumed. Teams are going to, I mean, he's never really pitched. We've never seen him at a right. level long enough.
Given the pitching landscape, we can't really say for sure that you're getting the ratios, just how things have looked so far.
I mean, and on top of that, again, it's four innings, but he's never really been much. I mean, his ground ball rate's been good, but how we haven't seen him do it over a consistent period. We don't know how good he could be with teams getting a consistent look at him. That's the thing. Miller has he's pitched literally. If you look, that's why I pulled up his Fangraphs page for people to look at. If you're watching, the innings are single digits at every stop. So he hasn't had a long enough time at any level. That's Mason Miller we're talking about. Hasn't had a long enough chance at any level for teams to adapt, for coaching staffs to adapt, for these things to happen to where we can see that correction. So now that he's going to get full run at the highest level with the best teams, the best players, it's not a guarantee that he's suddenly just going to keep doing this, because all we've had are such small samples to bank on that. And it's going to probably cost triple digits this week. And there's just too many red flags for me. And I probably was wrong not to be aggressive on Taj Bradley, but I'm hoping I won't be wrong for not being aggressive here. I'm sure a couple of my league mates are listening. You can have them. I'm not that in at cost. Yeah. I know people.
There's going to be others that you're going to regret not having enough fab for. So, I mean, like Brandon Fott, he's, there's speculation he could be coming up soon with Madison Bumgarner getting DFA'd.
I hope someone drops him after the news of like the other, I don't even, the name doesn't matter. Somebody else got called up for him already to start for him for Mad Bum, and it wasn't
Tommy Fab. Henry.
Yeah, him. So if that drives someone to drop him, I'm gonna be all over that. I'm gonna be all over that fad bid for sure.
Yeah, another one. There's some speculation on in Cleveland, Tanner Bibee.
That's probably the next Taj Bradley level prospect of like in terms of hype and in terms of bid quality, quantity too. I guess you're gonna be seeing those big bids for that type of guy too, I think.
Yeah, Ricky Tiedemann is another one that's gotten some hype, and he's looked fantastic so far in Double A. We've heard some good things from the GM there in Toronto about him, saying not much more he needs to prove down there. So yeah, there's gonna be some other guys.
And that was my thinking with Taj, but man, Taj looks so good. And I was probably wrong. I think where I was wrongest wasn't, again, I wasn't doubting the talent. I was doubting the Rays, but I don't think the Rays are going to toy with him. And I guess I'm just not used to that, because maybe they don't toy with their, and then someone pointed out to me on Twitter, they haven't really been toying with their pitchers. And I kind of missed that, because I think I'm just so used to them toying with Josh Lowe and Nate Lowe over the years. And just, they platoon everybody in that lineup. I kind of bled into the whole, that's how they treat. I feel like they used to treat their pitchers that way, but they used to play the games where they wouldn't even call them up while they're young. So that's another thing that's new, because they're calling up McClanahan, Baz, all these guys while they were still young. Whereas like, I feel like Price was kind of young, but like they made sure they got the extra year out of him and all that stuff. So that's one of those things where I'm like, I wonder if that's not a thing anymore. I still have to go back in this offseason and really adapt my process to realizing which teams are more aggressive, which teams won't play this game. Teams like the Pirates, who left O'Neill down last year, who are leaving down their top catching prospect and Andy Rodriguez. That like the Pirates become a team that like instantly I have a red flag. Like, okay, no top prospect from them am I drafting in most leagues or whatever. But like maybe a team like, oh wait, we know the Padres are aggressive with their prospects. We know. I'm trying to think of another team this year. Oh, like the White Sox brought up Colas. We saw Jordan Walker break camp at 20 years old for the Cardinals. These are going to be teams that now I'm making notes of, like, hey, these guys aren't on the 40 man, but we saw them be aggressive in the past with prospects. These guys might have a chance of breaking camp, even though they might not seem like it right now. And that's where that's a big thing that I think all of us have to adapt to being better at. But now it's going to turn into over aggressive. I feel like it's going to make us overly aggressive now, because now we're going to be like, oh yeah, these teams did it the last 3 years. This year they don't do it for whatever reason. Like Mason Wynn doesn't break camp next year for some reason, even though as long as he performs, he probably comes up for a cup of coffee later this year. But you get my point. It's like these guys like, yeah. But it's good, because it's going to make us, it's going to at least, but again, it's about building trends and building up, figuring out which teams are more likely to do these things and allow things to happen. And yeah, we're getting that information, because we don't technically have that data right now. You know what I mean? We're just we're speculating most of the time, but some teams are showing their hands more than others in terms of willingness to call these guys up and just have them run with it. All right.
Yeah.
We harped on this one enough. Let's move over to Juan Soto. I'll even just bring the page up here while we're talking about him. Juan Soto has just been off to a terrible start, all things considered. First round pick for many, second round for few. Doing his usual walking more than striking out, but the strikeouts are actually spiked for the first time in a few years, the highest of his career to this point, which is weird, considering that even as a 19-year-old kid, he only posted a 20% strikeout rate. Even it's 20.9%, so I'm being technical here. But the walks are also, he is walking or striking out 43% of the time. Wild. OBP of 372, while having a 194 batting average, the BABIP has not increased as we expected with the shift change. He has four home runs, so he's still hitting for power. Juan Soto, is this just kind of who he is now, or are we still going to see better things ahead? Like, I feel like it's been like an ongoing thing now at this point.
Well, we are seeing so far, like, it's marginal, but it's a career high called strike rate, career low swing rate. I mean, this was part of the problem for me. This was one of the reasons why I was off of him in draft season, where he was going like in the middle of the first round, was that I you know, his plate discipline is almost too good for fantasy, right? Like, if he's walking over 20% of the time, how impactful is his batting average going to be?
So OBP leagues, he's a gem.
absolutely. But yeah, just the, yeah, given the so struggle, good. The struggles with the batting average last year, and then it now carrying over into this year. But I'm not too concerned. I mean, we've seen this from hitters like this before. You know, there was a big, Jose Ramirez was one a few years ago that we saw this from, and then he just completely turned it around. I think Soto, given his skills, I mean, I think he will turn it around. But yeah, you definitely don't like to see. Yeah, you're discouraged with what he's done so far. But he's not the only one. There's a lot of guys off to slow starts, and I think he's going to be fine.
It's one of those things that maybe you should have tempered expectations with the batting average. We all thought maybe he could get closer to these first four. And I still think he can, because if Soto can get closer to that 312 BABIP, which was his lowest entering 2022. Was a 312 back in 2019, that was the juice ball days too, which is wild. His lowest BABIP. But considering the shift is gone, the amount of contact he can make, how good of an eye he has at the plate, I do think Soto is in for better days. But maybe we should be expecting closer to that 242 that he posted last year, compared to the 300 or the 280s that we saw in previous seasons. That's all. Yeah. But he's still an elite talent. But here's part of the issue though. At 55% ground ball rate is so bad.
Ground ball rate is back up over 50%, and he's pulling a lot of pulled grounders. So you don't like to see that. But his expected stats, he's still hitting the ball tremendously hard. 53% hard hit rate, 16% barrel rate. So he has a .418 slug and a .533 X slug. Things are going to turn around for Juan Soto. But yeah, like you just got to temper your expectations with that batting average. But yeah, I think he's going to be fine.
And I made the screen a little bigger for those who might need to see it, but the pulled ground ball rate is a 69.6%. Not so nice. But the pulled fly balls are still 26%, which isn't bad. It's just if he can elevate some more of those pulled balls. And I think it was Jeff Erickson on the RotoWire podcast was talking about how he heard or read something about that being an issue that Soto's aware of. So we'll see if that's something that they make a point to try to adapt or fix. But Soto's power is legitimate, I think, and he's such a good hitter. He has such a good eye at the plate that I don't see this being a long-term issue. The next player we should talk about is Jake McCarthy. So I talked about him on the last podcast, so anyone listening to this one, I'm going to let you give your thoughts on Mr. McCarthy. And do you expect him to bounce back, or was last year's second half a bit of a mirage? Get it, mirage, because they play in the desert? Sorry.
McCarthy. Yeah, I don't know. He was another one that I was off of just because I saw, the inflated .349 BABIP last year, the low hard hit rate, the swing and strike rate that showed that, there was a little bit more swing and miss there than the 21% strikeout rate indicated there was. So he hasn't struck out a ton so far, and the BABIP is down to 186. It's just a really big time overcorrection, but he's also not hitting the ball hard like at all. And I don't think he's someone that, like, they're gonna keep rolling out there if he's not producing? You know, they have outfielders, they have players. You know, Alec Thomas, his underlying metrics look much better. So, and you know, he's hitting. So yeah, I would be a little more concerned for sure with McCarthy.
I'm concerned with McCarthy as well. I expressed it as well in a rather deep breakdown this morning on the live stream / podcast, so I won't repeat my thoughts. If you are interested in that, listen to the last episode or check out the last live stream, and you can find that information there. Moving along to Matt Chapman. Obviously, he's not going to sustain this level of production, but there was a lot of us that really bought into him having a little bit of like a bounce back / breakout. We're obviously seeing 397 batting average, 461 OBP with a 750 slug, over 1,000 OPS, obviously. What's funny, though, is his WOBA is 512. His expected WOBA is 513. You don't usually see that inflated of a WOBA have the expected WOBA match. And if you look at his career numbers, his expected WOBA is usually in line with his WOBA, too, like at least the last 2 years. So it's funny, but you're seeing, you know, improvements in the strikeout rate he's making. But how much of that is the hot streak for Matt Chapman? The home runs are there. He even stole base. He's 1-for-3. The fact that he attempted three stolen bases blows my mind, because he only attempted 4 all of last year. He already has 3 attempts this year. I don't see the green light staying there for him because he's unsuccessful even with the new rules. But Matt Chapman is off to a blazing start. There are some encouraging changes, but obviously negative regression is coming. Overall, though, what are your thoughts on Matt Chapman's start, and where do you think he ends up compared to the last couple of seasons where we've seen him kind of decline in a sense?
My thoughts are that I am really upset that I don't have more Matt Chapman.
I thought you had a lot. Maybe you didn't. I know I got in late.
No, I was a year too early on Matt Chapman. I was all in last year. I thought, okay, like, you know, he's another year off from the hip issues. I think it was it like early 2021 or somewhere around that where he had the hip surgery. I don't remember exactly, but I was all in on Matt Chapman last year.
Look how red that is. It's so purdy.
Yeah.
Whoa, that's not normal. Outs above average, third percentile. He's going to correct that. He's such a good third baseman. Definitely, anyway. Definitely. But yeah, I just want to show the red. People like the red. People just like those red sliders. I think they're hilarious because they all say, like, three or four of them say the same things over and over again, basically.
Oh, yeah.
But it's just funny. It's just funny to show them because, like, obviously they're pretty red. Everyone likes them. But yeah, I mean, he's just stupid good right now, and obviously
this is the kind of season that, like, that you thought he can have when he was hitting 36 home runs in 2019 with just a 21.9% strikeout rate in Oakland. This was the kind of, like, if everything went right for Matt Chapman, this is what we're going to see, and it's happening. And I was a year too early, and I'm really upset that I don't have more Matt Chapman this year.
I'm really now, happy obviously, to have
like
him.
He's obviously not gonna have a 468 BABIP. He's not gonna hit damn near 400.
No. I don't believe you. This is real. All of it's real. Damn it. This is happening, right? The all in MVP season. Nothing goes wrong. Everything goes right. Season is. He's actually pulling the ball the least amount of his career right now, pretty much.
Yeah.
But you have to remember, he has good opposite field power, and the new fences should benefit him. The new fences that came in should all benefit him as well there in Toronto. But yeah, I want to believe. But if there's anything to be impressed about, it's the fact that the swing and miss. We're talking this will, if he continues to swing strike rate where it's at, we're talking 3 straight seasons of improved swinging strike rates. We're talking 3 straight seasons of improved Z contact rates and overall contact rates. Z contact is zone contact for those that don't know this or aren't familiar with the metrics, but Matt Chapman he's progressively gotten better each of the last 3 years in some of these metrics. And it's like, is it finally all coming together? Is it a contract year for him too? Is that part of it? Maybe
it is a contract year.
There it is. Boom. Nailed it.
We found it. We got to the bottom of it.
Yeah. He'll suck next year. You guys are all going to buy into the third round price tag. He's going to be next year's Austin Riley, but Austin Riley's younger and entering his prime. Chapman's going to be exiting his anyway. But yeah, I just wanted to say that this is real. This is going to happen, and he's never slowing down. This is it. This is the magical league winning pick that we all wanted to find. We found it. All right, that's it. But Jared Kelnick, speaking of league winners, he's a guy that we've been chasing the dream on for years, and it's coming together. He's hitting 310, 385, 603 strikeout rate. That's the big thing. 24.6%. this year. And that's coming off of, you know, 33% last year, 28% in the year before. This is just the major league K rates for Kelnick. He's always been this type of good strikeout guy in the minors. Finally seeing it come to fruition. He has the stolen bases as well. We know the skill, we know the power and speed are there. Those skill sets were never questioned. It was the swing and miss. Obviously, a 368 BABIP is inflated. So I don't think he's a 300 hitter either, 310 batting average. But ultimately, what I'm getting at is that there's a lot of positive changes happening early on. You're seeing him take pitches inside out. You're seeing him hit pitches high in the zone. It looks like he's finally figuring it out. Are you optimistic? Do you think it's a bit of a fluke? Do you think the old Jared Kelnick's going to stand up here and ruin everything for everyone? Where are you at with him?
It's hard to say the old Jared Kelnick when he's only 23 years old.
The young Jared Kelnick, stand up.
I think he's another one where, like, I saw what he was doing in the spring, but it was like, you look at his AAA numbers. Right. You look at his AAA numbers and it's like, well, he's done this before. I mean, he had over 1,000 OPS in 2021 in AAA. He had, where is it at? He had a 922 OPS in AAA last year. I mean, it's like, okay, he's done this before, but every time he's gotten his chance in the majors, he's fallen flat on his face. And so I wasn't sure what to, like, if it was believable in the spring, but he's obviously carried it over now into the regular season. And the good thing, another encouraging thing too, I mean, he's been in the lineup the last two games against lefties, and he's actually hit lefties pretty well so far. This rate was a 4-for-11, super small sample, but I mean, it's just a little encouraging there. And like you said, the strike rate is down, walk rate's up. It is 65 plate appearances, so it's not exactly nothing. Yeah, I mean, I think this was a big, I think he's going to end up being a big time value there.
Yeah, I have one share and I made a point to get him in my FOMO draft, where my FOMO draft included George Springer, Corbin Carroll, Jared Kelnick. You can see it's off to quite the start. It's actually, last I checked, it was like a top 25 overall DC team too. So it's like, it's just the type of start. It's had everyone who's hot, because like I just got a bunch of FOMO guys. They're all hitting. I think I have Chapman on that team too, which I already had Chapman, but I didn't have enough. So it's just one of those teams where everybody, like, it's starting off as good as you can on the hitting side. The pitching side, I also have Chris Sale. I was very thankful. I started him this week. I was very thankful for the bounce back because he was looking rough. I think I have Woodruff on that team too. I have Kevin Gossman. No one cares about that, all my teams. But my point was, is just that it's funny that I finally got that FOMO team and I finally got my share of them. And I wish I had more though. Cause yeah, I was with you. I was kind of afraid to buy in. Kelnick's all he's done is let us down to this point, you know, but 23 years old, but the thing is, and then you can, the counter argument would be, well, look what Adele's done. Adele's never come around on that prospect pedigree and kind of had the same questions in terms of the plate discipline. But I think the difference was, is, didn't Adele kind of have some of those issues in the minors? Whereas Kelnick never did. So that might be the big difference there. But anyway, Kelnick's just making these strides, taking these big steps forward. Like the lack of chasing, the lack of swinging strikes, they're both career best and both better than league average, while increasing all the contact rates in the process. Makes sense. Obviously, he's swinging less, so he's a little more patient, he's picking his spots better. There's a lot to like here in Kelnick's profile in terms of just what he's doing under the hood, and obviously the production will follow because he is just naturally gifted as a baseball player. But yeah, we can move on. Sorry, I was checking. Obviously, I'm just checking my teams because I have addiction problems with fantasy baseball. Better than anything else, I guess. So we can talk about some of these. One last surger, and then we'll talk about some slow starters. Yandy Diaz, he's a guy that I feel like this was the first year. I think I got shut out. Yandy's always been a safe, solid fantasy producer. And just somebody you can kind of plug in your corner infield, set him, forget him. We know the biceps are there. We know he's a big dude. We know he's strong. We know he can hit home runs if he really tried to. And it looks like he's finally trying to. And look at the launch angle. And launch angle is actually more of a reflective thing to what he's doing. So it's something I talked to a prospect mind about this. And pretty much it's not the complete correct thing. So I can't say this is right for like everything, but the essential premise is players go after a ball with a certain attack angle, and that attack angle allows them to hit more fly balls or whatever. And then what you're seeing is the launch angle as a production of that attack angle. So the launch angle is reflective of the fact that he's hitting more fly balls, not the reason he's hitting more fly balls, if that makes sense. I think we've – and that's how I've learned it now, because I used to always lean on it as a crutch as to, oh, he changed his launch angle. No, they changed their attack angle, and the launch angle is a product of that, from my understanding, in terms of how the balls fly. I could be wrong. I apologize if I'm wrong again, but that's how I understand it when I talk to some people that are smarter than me about this stuff. I digress. My point is if you look at that, you know he's hitting more fly balls, and we know that's all he ever needed. And with this, he's barreling the ball more. Yandy's freaking amazing. Talk about him. You go ahead. He's always been – we've all loved Yandy for years.
Yeah, I don't know about attack angle and all that, but, I mean, I'm looking at, like, his rolling graphs. I mean, his 32.1% ground ball rate would be a career low
That's huge.
Right now. So, yeah, I mean, there definitely seems to be some changes there. And, yeah, he's 6 home runs already. After last year, he had 9 all season in 558 plate appearances. He's got 6
in 76. 17% barrel rate. He has 9 barrels. He had 20 all last year. He's already like, that's absurd. Like, okay, folks at home listening, watching, these are the types of changes that you look at early in the season and make changes in your idea of who this player was, because obviously this is not the same Yandy Diaz as we've known for the last 5 years. This is a new and improved Yandy Diaz. Now, will it sustain all season long? Can't say that for certain. We saw Hosmer do this, and we saw Hosmer do this in 2020 in that shortened season. Hosmer, he finally did it. We finally got what we wanted from Hosmer. And if you actually watch his rolling graphs on his launch angle and everything else, it was just ground balls went up, launch angle dipped down. It was like slowly over the course of those 2 months. So this could just be very well an early change. But at the end of the day, you know, at least in the short term, Yandy Diaz is this guy. Like, the plate discipline's still there. The contact skill is still there. He's walking more than he's striking out, while he's barreling the ball more than ever and hitting it harder than ever. And all those skills have always been there. It's just a matter of him finally putting it together. And it's glorious. I have no shares, I don't think. And it's he's 31. So I'm sorry, but you don't usually see a 31-year-old breakout like this. And I'm buying it with Yandy in comparison to, like, I don't know. I'm sure there's other 30-year-old break. Oh, like Brent Rooker. Like, if you're trying to compare the two in terms of, like, oh, look, they're both old men breaking out. Yeah, but Yandy's always had this. Rooker's always had hot streaks. And I think Yandy's kind of, I don't even know how old Rooker is. I think he's close to 30. I'm just guessing. I just picked a name that's hot and, you know, kind of like a guy that we wouldn't get, like, actually believe in. But you get my point, though. But here, this, anyway, back to Yandy. You have anything to add? Because I kind of cut you off, because I'm really good at that. I got really excited.
No. That's pretty much it, man. Yeah. I'm, like you said, is there going to be some, you know, ebbs and flows in that ground ball rate throughout the season? Is he going to revert back to, you know, the Yandy we've seen the last few years here and there? Like, I'm sure we're going to see that. But it's definitely encouraging to see the production he's put up already. You're definitely already been rewarded based on, like, where he was going in drafts. So if he ends up being a 20 to 25 home run with, you know, 280 to 300 average, hitting atop that Rays lineup that is just a machine right now. I mean, yeah, he's absolutely has been one of the steals of the drafts.
He's going to be a top 100 player at this point, and you got him around pick 300. That's the type of, like, these old boring guys that have these random breakouts. These are huge guys in terms of return on investment. You'll see, and like a guy like Jose Siri, who was kind of like starting off in that type of trend of post 300 moving. Like, I think he'll still be able to get there, but you get my point. Like, you have to identify these values in drafts. Like, you might pick the right guys early, but if you're not picking the guys late, everybody's getting good players early. You got to hit on these guys late. Matt Chapman's kind of in that range, obviously a little earlier. He was more of like a top 150 guy, but guys like, I don't know. I'm trying to think of names. I don't know. Josh Naylor was supposed to be a guy like that, but he's not. He sucks. But like, Gleyber Torres started off so hot, man. We like the first week or two, we were like, oh my God, he's awesome. He's stealing bases. He's 5 for 8 now, but he was like 5. I think he had 5 for 6. He got caught a couple times. It doesn't matter. But 5 for 8 on the stolen bases, 2 home runs, walking more than striking out. Another good sign there. Some bad BABIP luck. Overall, though, I think he's going to be just fine. Didn't he have like a little, didn't he get nicked up on some type of thing too? I feel like there was a small little injury that kept him day to day that he hasn't gone on the IL for, though. That
yeah, it was like his hip was bothering him or something.
Do you remember when that happened?
I want to say it was about a week ago. I think he missed one game last week. I think he sat out.
Let's look from the ninth. Let's just look from the ninth out of curiosity. Since the ninth, because I just picked the random date 10 days ago, he's batting 125. Strikeouts, more than no power. Caught stealing once. If that's right around the date that it happened, maybe there's a reason. Maybe that's actual, like, okay, the hip isn't right now. That's all. It could be that. It could be as simple as that. Overall, though, he still looks very great on paper, obviously. But I'm just curious. If I go back and find the date of when he had that little hiccup and correlate that with the stats, I guarantee you there's a correlation there before and after.
Yeah, yeah. When we're getting our, like, names together today, I had mentioned him along and another. Because, I mean, these were guys that, like, kind of had – some helium had their backers. You know, I was one of them. I loved Glaber, and Taylor Ward was another. And they were just fresh on the mind because I was just watching the Angels and Yankees this afternoon. And I'm like, come on, Glaber, Taylor Ward, like, you guys do something. both of them are definitely the gift
where you're poking him with a stick, like, do something already.
You see the Yankees put up, you know, these runs, and it's like, Glaber 1 for 5, 1 run. I mean, okay, but yeah.
Okay, ready? 9. Okay, 9 runs. Oswaldo Cabrera is 0 for 4. Meanwhile, Kepler on my bench is 2 for 5 with an RBI. Like, come on, that's way more useful. Anyway,
yeah,
I'm regretting the hell out of that move right now. But hey, Jonathan India is doing. Jonathan India did work for me today. I'll take it. Anyway,
yeah.
Glaber
and Ward in particular, like, they. All their production has come in, like, the first week, and they've been ice cold the last 2 years, but I mean, the last 2 weeks. But like you pointed out, I mean, like, Glaber's walked more than he struck out. BABIP's a little down. I think both of these guys, if they have, if there are owners that are getting frustrated with rostering them based on how ice cold they've been the last 2 weeks. I mean, I definitely, like, they're guys that I would go put out, like, some buy low offers for sure.
So the injury occurred on the 11th. So I pulled up his stats, like, when he was first pulled early due to it.
Yeah.
He's hitting even worse. So if you include the 11th from the 11th till the 19th, so what, 30 plate appearances. Again, we're talking small samples here. A negative 12 WRC plus, batting 080. Not like 180 or 800, no, 080. He's batting 80 with a 154 wOBA. And not obviously the power hasn't been there. He got caught stealing. If you look at the barrels here, I'll actually share the tab now. I realize that if you actually look at the barrels, we're talking at the hard hit rate plummeted 31.6%, 0 barrels over the span. Again, we're talking a very small sample. But if you look at if you look up until, like, we'll say the 10th, obviously, we'll go to this. I got to do the 10th here. Which means oh my goodness, I suck at this. Okay, so we go from opening day to the 10th, because obviously I'm dumb. And you look at all that. Look, barrel rate was 14%. Hard hit rate was up. Not great, but still up. You look at the overall production. Amazing. There's honestly a core. I feel like there's a true correlation. 41 plate appearances, almost exactly half the plate appearances. You can see a true correlation before injury, after injury. This would make for a good tweet, actually, which I might steal and do. But the point was to show this as a, hey, look, there is correlation here. There is something going on with Glaber that that makes sense why the production has hindered. And that's why maybe he's not fully healthy. That's why he's DH. They called it Peraza because of Donaldson, but they're also making a point to DH Glaber, which could be speaking to his health as well. Obviously, he's probably not 100%. I don't know. That's where my head's at with this one.
Yeah.
You mentioned Taylor Ward. You want to talk about him? Is there anything that you've noticed in his profile? Another guy that started off hot. I didn't see any noticeable injuries or issues with him. So.
No, I didn't either. I was just kind of put him in the same bucket with Glaber. Just because I have so much of Ward and Glaber, and I see Ward today, I mean, 0 for 5.
He's not barreling a damn thing right now, which is weird considering he's coming off back-to-back seasons, double-digit barrel rate. So that's one thing. Ground ball rate slightly up, a lot of fly balls, a little more infield fly balls. Maybe he's getting under the ball a little bit. That's the only thing for Taylor Ward. And if this is why I do quick scrolls of players, like, okay, so I see that. That's kind of a thing. He's chasing more. The swing strike rate's not up, but he is being so. I think maybe he's pressing because the swing rate is higher than last year. I mean, not too much higher compared to the previous years, but it's up. And then, the big thing is the chase rate. The first time ever in his career, it's above 29.2%. It's at 32.7%, which is about league average, a little worse than league average. And he's still making 92% Z contact. I don't see. I think it's more of like just a slow stretch. Maybe he's pressing ever so slightly, getting under the ball a little bit. I do expect better days ahead for Ward. This is just a quick look at him from my point of view. My first time looking at them, I like to do these quick little look. And when people, what people don't know is for years, me and George would not have an outline, and we would just randomly like, here's five names, let's talk about them. And I would do this live on the podcast anyway. But now you get to see me do it live on the podcast if you're watching. So it's like, I would just like, and you could tell when I prep versus when I don't prep, or if I usually have a shit ton of, excuse my language, I usually don't curse on this podcast. I usually have a bunch of information top of mind all the time. Let's talk about Anthony Santander then. That could be one of the last things we discuss before we get out of here. It's been about an hour, a little over an hour, because we like to talk baseball. And Santander is another hot topic name. I've seen people talk about dropping him. Obviously, very uncharacteristic strikeout rate, but he's also walking more than ever. It's almost like, I wonder if it's a passivity issue because the BABIP's higher than usual and he's still only hitting 206. Yeah.
He's another one where I did want to put like bring him up in contrast to the guys like Glaber and Taylor Ward, where like you've seen still a lot of similar like underlying numbers for Ward and Glaber. Like it's not like too far out of the box, but like Anthony Santander, I mean, he's striking out 32% of the time, and yeah, he doesn't typically have that kind of strikeout rate. And despite a 300 BABIP, he's only hitting 206. Now he's one that I believe sat out a couple games last week as well with a back issue. So that might be a thing where like, yeah, he's just not comfortable up at the plate right now, at the moment. He still has a 48% hard hit rate, a 9.8% barrel rate. So he has gotten a bit unlucky, but just like given the strikeout rate, maybe I'm a little more concerned, but I do expect him to turn it around too. Hopefully, like, you know, if there is some kind of underlying thing that him and like, and Glaber like dealing with, then maybe just given a little bit of time, we'll start to see them bounce back. But yeah, this one does give me a little bit more concern, just given how much he's striking out right now.
Yeah, and the thing is it's either uncharacteristic or it's red flags, and it's hard to tell. Again, this is when it's like, I would kind of like to defer to track record the last few years for him. And although he's always been an aggressive hitter, Santander's chasing more than ever, pretty much 40% of the time, mm-hmm. Almost 41% of the time, compared to still being a pretty high chase rate guy, 35%, 36.7 last 2 years for Santander. But the big thing here is he's swinging more than usual, at least more than last year. Again, I keep saying last year because last year was the breakout, but the year before it was kind of in this range. But another thing, the big thing here is actually the Z contact, the zone contact, 76%. He hasn't been below 83% since his rookie season in 2017. So that's weird. And then the swinging strike rate is the lowest it's also been since 2017. The highest in a bad way. It's bad. It's a bad number. It's 14.1%. League average is about 11.1. At least it was this morning when I looked. So that's what you're getting at. It's like you're getting some swing and miss in his game, a little more swinging last year, a little more chasing. Maybe he's not seeing the ball well. Maybe he's pressing. And the big thing I did notice too, I was highlighting while you were talking, was the infield fly ball rate really spiked for some reason. It's at 26.3%. It was the highest it's ever been, was like 19% a couple years ago. He has hovered around 19% multiple times in his career, never 26.3%. So, and the home run fly ball rate is pretty much 10% lower than his usual output there too. I think it's just a matter of him getting right. Look, 56.1% pull rate tells me he's probably pressing. Pull rate, pulling fly balls, trying to really make a point to get back on track. I think Santander is. It comes off to me as pressing. But maybe it's the back lingering. Maybe there could be a bunch of things. But I'm not quite ready to panic, and like I'm not dropping him. I'm definitely benching him right now. No. Like if I have Jake Berger or Kerry Carpenter, I trotted those guys out over Josh Naylor, who I still rather have moving forward right now than Santander. For reference, and Josh Naylor just pisses me off. You know what? I will do one more little look because he wasn't part of the outline, but we got to see. Because last time I looked at him, I'm like, oh, he's not that bad. He's going to do whatever. He had a couple home runs, I think, at one point. He's still doing Josh Naylor things. What the hell's going on? Why do you have a 143 BABIP as a lefty this year when there's no shift, jerk? And and for reference, he's a 273 BABIP guy. He's never really been a big BABIP guy, regardless of the shift. But 14% K rate, walking more than usual, so he's actually being overpatient, which is weird. Has the two home runs, like I mentioned. But batting 153 with a 143 BABIP, I think that's part of it. His ex WOBA is over 130, about 130 points higher than his actual WOBA. So he's been unlucky there too. Yeah. So I think it's, oh man, I actually feel way more, I'm already more comfortable than Santander. His hard hit rates are a little low, but kind of not that much lower than in line last year. His barrel rate's a little lower than last year, but pretty much in line. I think that comes around with him obviously getting better. He's actually hitting less ground. He's hitting a career best ground ball rate of 37%. He's also spiking the most fly balls of infield fly balls of his career. So he's getting under the ball a little much there probably. And obviously,
yeah, I think all these things will normalize.
I do too, but I'm wondering, is he trying to put the ball in the air more? And that's causing some of these bad BABIP issues. Cause if you are putting the ball, it's a 49% fly ball rate. That's extreme. And it's obviously a 16% infield fly ball rate. So BABIP is due to correct, even with this approach. However, people need to understand that BABIP also sometimes is earned. People often cite BABIP blindly without understanding that sometimes a player's BABIP is low based on their approach. And if he's hitting 50% of the balls in the air and 43, say majority of those, we'll look up his actual his fly ball rates direction of the field, but say majority of those are going to center field, those are going to be flyouts. He's going to have a bad BABIP. And if he's popping up, if he's hitting 16% of them in the infield, Naylor's going to have a bad BABIP. So right now, the BABIP, although bad, is somewhat his own doing in terms of who's at fault. It's his. And I think we don't stress enough as analysts. People just, oh, bad BABIP, it's going to regress. Is it, though? I feel like you need to put context to it, and we don't do enough of that. But otherwise, still the same elite discipline in terms of, like, swing strike rate, sub 10%. Contact, Z contact, 89.5%. That's his league average. Sorry, 93.9% is his Z contact. Second, that's actually the highest of his career right now. He's doing this while being more aggressive at the plate, a little slightly, while chasing more even. Like, he makes a ton of contact. It's not a contact issue. I think it's a quality of contact issue because we saw those take a little bit of a dip for Naylor. But mostly, I think he's just too many fly balls. Like, normally, you want players hitting more fly balls, but not when they're not going to the poolside, which also might be an issue, which we're going to look at right now. You're seeing me. I'm tilting right now, and I'm trying to find, like, I want answers. at least I'm more comfortable. Like, Santander has more red flags than this. Naylor just, I think it's more of like, okay, he'll figure it out. Santander actually has a lot more swing and miss and other concerns. But where's the batted ball content here? Batted ball pulled fly ball rate is 35.3% of the time. The fact when it warms up, that's gonna turn into a lot of home runs. 35.3% pulled fly balls. Naylor is not he's a good power guy. I think those pull fly balls are going to leave the park more times than not if he keeps this approach up. I like what I'm saying. You know what? Buy low on Josh Naylor if you trade. I had to rant. I was getting, because I benched him. I keep, especially against lefties, I keep benching him. He's been terrible. But I don't know. I think there's better days ahead, though. I actually am encouraged by what I saw there. But screw Santander. Anyway, other than getting married, which, you know, you picked baseball season to do this, which was dumb. No, but congratulations, buddy. 200 episodes. We almost, you know, we've almost quit this podcast like five times, but I'm trying, you know, we're keeping it going now. hopefully 200 more episodes. That'd be a lot of fun. But all things considered, George, I'm really happy to call you a partner, but also now we've actually become friends. You know, we've met in First Pitch Arizona, and obviously we plan to do that again sometime in the future. And honestly, if I could have made it to your wedding, I would have loved to be there, but we live across the country from one another.
Yeah.
So it logistically is really tough, but all things considered, I'm really happy to call you a friend, buddy. 200 episodes has been a lot of fun, and honestly, congratulations on getting married. I'm really happy to see. I've kind of watched you grow up a little bit. You know, we've been there for the last 4 or 5 years.
That's right. Yeah, I was a single man when we started this, and yeah. Now I'm getting married next weekend. So
you're welcome. I take full credit. If Simeon's listening, Simeon, I take full credit for everything that everyone does in their lives. You're welcome, George.
thank you. No, but I feel the same, man. If there's anything that I've gotten from this, it, you know, you and Zach and Simeon, as much as you guys go at it, and Bubba,
and not Bubba's part of the mix, yeah,
absolutely. I mean, this has been, like, I honestly feel blessed. No matter where this podcast goes, that, like, you know, I've made some really good friends.
The fact that you make friends, people, you know, it's, you know, hard to make friends as an adult. I've lost more friends than I've made. I've lost more friends than I've made as an adult, and it's the common love of a game, and it's the fact that we bounce ideas off of each other. We don't always agree, and I do wish we disagreed more, and I'm going to make a point. Maybe our next podcast, we get together, we'll talk about how great your wedding was, and we'll just find a podcast we can argue about things. Because I think there's just a lot of, it's almost like an echo chamber, unfortunately, because we've been working together so long that it's rare that we don't agree. And on top of that, when we don't agree, it's usually with reasoning that it's like, okay, I guess I see that. But next year, I'm going to make a point that, you know what, I need Simeon because I just hate him. So I make a point to disagree with him. But yeah, in all seriousness, George, I really do appreciate it. Everyone watching, I know we just got some new viewers. We're going to be heading out. The whole thing, the whole live stream is going to be uploaded on YouTube. Check it out. The podcast itself will be out in the morning. So appreciate everyone watching, listening. Until next time, I'm Mike. You can follow me on Twitter at Mike_Kurland. George, as always, joining me, Jorge at Roto_Nino. Check us out on Patreon, patreon.com/GTEFantasy. And of course, 5-star rating review on the podcast is greatly appreciated. And until next time, we will talk to you soon.